And welcome.
I'd like to begin with a story. Okay, good. Maybe some of the brave ones will move to the center. Good. Okay, good. Again, you're welcome to sit outside this spot. I'd like to begin with a story of something that, an event that occurred in my life about 15 years ago. Actually more than that, a profound, even I would say even a spiritual moment, when I was taking a walk with a friend of mine on kibbutz, actually Kfutzat Yavne, which is a kibbutz right near the Shiva Karim Yavne. And it was a time in the summertime when we were taking a walk, and on that particular kibbutz, they happen to have a cow farm, a milk farm, and it's a nice place to walk. I know Jeremy, remember, the old days of Shiva, good. So we happened to be walking by at a time where there was a cow that was actually giving birth. So at that point in my life, I had never seen anything like that, obviously. And at first, we didn't really know what was going on. So they separated one of the cows, and she was standing by herself and looked very uncomfortable. And then there was a crowd that grew around, and there was someone who was standing near her and helping her. Then we finally figured out what was going on. It became a real, it was something quite, interesting and fascinating to watch. We saw the new calf emerge, and it was quite an amazing sight to see. What happened next, which is something that I knew happens, many mammals, and cows are no exception, when they're born, immediately start to walk within a few moments. But I guess Eino Doma Shmiya Kriya, you cannot compare learning about something and look actually seeing it. And seeing that take place was perhaps in some ways even more remarkable and amazing than the actual birth itself. You saw a mammal that had, never opened its eyes before, never seen the light of day, suddenly emerged, come into the world, and within seconds, maybe minutes, it certainly wasn't more than that, was standing, was walking around, was shaking a little bit and wobbling and probably fell over a couple of times, but literally within minutes was walking around. That's pretty much, to the best of my knowledge, that's pretty much the norm, more or less, in the animal kingdom. Humans, perhaps, are unique in some respects in that particular area, that not only are children completely dependent upon their parents or their caretakers not in any way independent other than perhaps one or two instincts that they're born with, but this is something that takes many, many months and years for them to develop to the point where they can reach some minimal level of independence. There are many reasons. Biologists will explain why it is that animals would be able to survive in the wild in such a way, but leaving all the interesting scientific blunders aside for a moment, it's clear that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, by design, made it such that human beings require a tremendous amount of time and people and nurturing and development. And this is something that, once again, is sort of woven into the fabric of creation. And we sometimes have to take a look out into the animal world to appreciate how unique human is in this respect, in particular, the fact, once again, that it requires so much time and so much nurturing for a child simply to be able to walk, and obviously so much more in terms of more sophisticated, higher levels of thinking, behavior, and development. We're going to begin tonight to introduce the topic of chinuch, which is a very, very broad, major topic, can mean many, many different things, and probably does mean many different things to different people here. And I don't expect, and I'm going to say from the outset, nobody should expect of me to possibly be able to, even in 45 minutes or so, to be able to cover even a significant amount of material. At the same time, I want to try to focus tonight on a specific aspect of chinuch, and that is to focus from a more technical, legal, even halachic perspective, and not focus on that which we typically do think about and reflect upon and discuss with others when we speak about chinuch, and that is the hashkafa, the philosophy of chinuch. We're going to devote a couple of shiurim in the coming weeks, and perhaps give us an opportunity to create more opportunities in the near future if there's interest. But the purpose of tonight is once again just to outline some of the basic technical obligations that we have as parents and even as adults, and as we'll mention briefly later, not even necessarily as parents, in terms of being mechanech, properly training and educating children. And that will hopefully lay the groundwork so that in the coming weeks and opportunities in the future, we can discuss more important issues of Hashkafa. There are many issues that we may, you know, stumble upon tonight, indirectly, which we will not really be addressing directly. So I'll just say from the outset, issues that require maintaining some sort of balance in the home, managing difficult schedules, juggling responsibilities, dealing with kids who have different strengths and abilities and weaknesses, setting limits for us, giving space within the home, special needs children. So this is a few of the very, very important, real and relevant topics that we all confront with, on a regular basis that I'm not really going to spend any direct time on this evening. If anybody has any questions as we're learning, so feel free to interrupt as we go along, and hopefully we'll walk away with at least something which we can build a foundation on and move forward. I'd like to begin also by one additional segment of introduction by putting forth, perhaps you can come up with 30 such misconceptions, but in my mind, there are at least three significant misconceptions that people have when they consider or think about the word chinuch, which once again means many things to different people, but in the brief time I sat down to think about this, I came up with at least three that were very, prominent in my mind. The first is that many people think of chinuch as a question of education and teaching and training our children, both from an intellectual perspective as well as from a perspective of their developing their spirituality and that sense within inside of each and every one of our children. But the view of chinuch is something which is basically to be able to transmit, to give over to our children information. And that is true. However, there's an entire other element to chinuch, or to Jewish education, which really makes it unique, I believe, and when we contrast or compare it to any other type of discipline or any other thing that we would teach our children, it's really something that we have very little in terms of the secular world to draw from. And that is how important it is that we, through the process of training our children and educating them, develop within inside of themselves a sense and appreciation of what it means to conform to a higher will and a higher authority, what it means to submit our own interests and our own independence and our own personal wishes and desires before the will of a higher being. This is difficult because we by nature, by design, are rebellious and people don't like being told what to do, particularly children, but even as adults, perhaps we deal with conflicts differently, but the way God made us, that's what we mean when we say we have a Yetzer Hara, is we want to do our own thing and we don't like to be told what to do. We live in a day and age where this is particularly challenging because our entire culture is about everyone being able to express their own individual self and being able to develop their own unique self, which is something that we as Torah Jews should value as well and should appreciate and should also encourage within our children. At the same time, we do have certain absolute values and absolute truths that we don't want to compromise in any way. And it's difficult to convey this in a atmosphere which is loving, which is supportive, which is encouraging, but at the same time be able to see to it that our children are realizing regularly that, you know, this is something that we can't do, or this is something that we must do. This is a story that comes to mind, something that was very, you know, revealing to me as a parent. A number of years ago, my kids were watching the movie Fiddler on the Roof. So we're not going to talk about watching movies with kids now. We'll talk about it another time. And my daughter, one of my daughters, who was probably about 9 years old at the time, she was watching the movie, and there's a scene in the movie, I'm not very familiar with it, but I saw it at least once, where one of the children in the family runs away with the non-Jew, right? She intermarries, right? Everybody remember her name? I don't remember. Whatever her name is. Huddle, right, good. I think so, Huddle, good. Anyway, so Huddle runs away with the Russian. And the way the story takes place in the play, in the movie, is that basically they disown her. They say, that's it, we have nothing to do with anyone. I don't remember if they said Shiva or not. But basically they had to make a very painful choice as parents that if you're going to do this, so then we're essentially cutting off our connection with you. So again, you know, I have at least one or two other children perhaps watching it at the time. I didn't really faze them, but one of my children, again, it was about 9 years old at the time, was blown away by that and said, you know, how could that be? And obsessed over it to the point where she, you know, on a number of occasions, you know, immediately after the movie and the next day and the next day, was forcing me to answer a question that I didn't want to answer. And as, would you do that to me? Would you do that to me? It's a very difficult question for anyone to ever have to answer. God forbid anybody should be faced with that. But to look at a very, very well-meaning, sincere, a very concerned 9-year-old, which on one hand has tremendous spiritual conviction, but also thinks that her parents love her unconditionally and would do anything in the world for her. So to be asked, push comes to shove, if I did that, you know, would you also, you know, I don't know what word she used, would you cut me off? And again, I honestly don't remember what I told her. I don't know what I would tell her today. It's a very, very difficult question to answer because, but leaving that aside, it's that point, and again, hopefully that particular test is one that people should never know of, but it's that concept that we really need to try to convey to our children, hopefully once again in a much less threatening way. But yeah, there is a certain point where we, even as your parents, acknowledge and recognize that there is a higher will in the world and there's a God that we serve, and we serve Him at all costs, however difficult and painful it may be. Which leads me to the next misconception that I think many people have, and that is people believe that the primary, if not exclusive, goal of chinuch is to get our children to love serving God and to love doing mitzvahs. Now, obviously, I think everybody who has ever heard me speak about this topic or even a related topic would know that that's certainly something which should be a very high priority, and we really should never settle for anything less. We would never want to raise our children observe mitzvahs and not enjoy it, but at the same time, they also need to see and understand that like any system in life, any legal system or any way of life, it's not always easy. There are times that it is somewhat imposing, and it's not always fun, and it's sometimes it's particularly challenging. And I think in today's day and age, there's a tremendous concern within the community that so many kids have been at risk and go off the derech, that we want to make we really want to be sure that the children really do enjoy observance of God and they do walk away with a meaningful connection, a positive connection to mitzvos, which is important, but we cannot forget that at the same time part of chinuch is that again, this is something real, this is something that we are committed to when we enjoy it, and at the time, for whatever reasons, when we do not. It's interesting, one of the questions that I ask the Bar Bat Mitzvah kids when I meet with them, it's actually my favorite discussion that I have with kids always, is to tell me what they love most about being a Jew and what they find most challenging and difficult. And it's amazing to me, quite frankly, that most kids can never think about anything that they find really to be particularly challenging as a Jew. You know, and maybe it would not surprise you. I'll ask, what do you think? Again, I don't keep track. I don't keep written data. But I know in my mind what is the most common answer that I get from a 12-year-old girl or 13-year-old boy, what is the most difficult part about being a Jew? Anyone want to take a guess? No. Every once in a while.
Fasting.
Fasting. Now, I find that so amazing because, I mean, at this point, these kids have fasted maybe, you know, a handful of times in their life. That's what they, like, dread when they think about, you know, what it means to be a Jew. That's right. So, obviously, it says so much about who, but what's most profound about that is it shows that, you know, really they have been able to, it seems, you know, carve out a way of life, a way of observing mitzvot that really, it's smooth sailing. There's no conflicts whatsoever. 5 times of the year, you know, I can't eat for the day. But other than that, there's no conflict in my life whatsoever. You know, I say to them, what about, you know, Lashon Hara, you find out, like, easy not to, right, you know. This is like, you know, and I start pointing out, you know, there probably are other things that you would find challenging. Every once in a while, there are kids that actually do reflect upon, you know, more meaningful challenges that they have in their life. But most of them, you know, clearly have not thought about it before. And when I force them to come up with something, they'll say something like fasting, which again, I think reveals that which may be, you know, an area which has gone unaddressed. And that's something we need to address as well. The third misconception is that the primary, and this is related really to the second, but that the primary exclusive goal of chinuch is to see to it that our children understand what it is that they are doing. Now again, There is obviously no substitute for a proper education, and we want the Avodas Hashem not to be something which is merely by rote. We don't want them to parrot. We want it to be meaningful. But once again, that's not the be-all and end-all. In fact, the Rambam, in his commentary on the Mishnayos and Masechus Menachos, points out that the word chinuch, which is again the word that we use and associate with Jewish education, means a way of training a person, lehisragel, for a person to train himself to practice something so that they're able to basically develop a certain behavior. And no different, perhaps, than an athlete would go ahead and engage in a certain behavior or practice or exercise again and again and again and again just to train themselves mentally, physically, etc. So to a certain extent, that is one of the more important goals of chinuch. And we sometimes fall into the trap of trying to see to it that our children understand everything and believe in their mind that understanding is not only a virtue, which it is, but once again, if you don't understand, then the level of commitment is not there or not to the same extent. So that is something as well which is really such a basic and fundamental point, but it's one that I think easily goes overlooked. And again, as somebody who's been teaching for a number of years, and particularly I taught, usually boys between the ages of 13, 14, 15 years old, a lot of them have this attitude of, well, I don't understand this, or why is this relevant? And if you can't explain it to me in the way that I understand, so then I'm going to give some serious thought as to whether or not I'm committed to this. And again, they won't all express it that way, but that's clearly the attitude that many have, which again is part of that very same, I think, modern approach that we have to life in general, and that is it's a very self-centered, ego-centered view on life, and again, it's an important part of their development, and one that we should seek to nurture, that they should stop and think and understand what they're doing and why they're doing it. I don't deny that for a moment, but we also have to be able to convey to them that at times we don't understand, at times we don't enjoy, but again, there is that concept of the higher will. Now, I introduced tonight's topic with these three points, because I think it's important as we begin to discuss some of these technical, more rigid questions which come up, and the question of conforming to halacha and having the times to impose certain restrictions and things on our children, which may seem a little overbearing, we should understand that this is part and parcel of our responsibility as parents and as mechanchim. And needless to say, but just to make one disclaimer, everything that I'm going to say this evening, while it is, based on the research that I've done, it is, if I tell you this is a halacha, so it is a halacha, but there's certainly always room for flexibility, and certainly in this regard, we have to be very careful that being that we're not dealing simply with a lulav or a piece of matzah, but we're dealing with the life of not just one of our children, but someone who has the potential, obviously, to reach very great heights, or God forbid, something else, we need to see to it that we are applying the halach in the proper way, and if and when even some of the more conventional approaches that should be suspended and perhaps substituted for another approach if and when appropriate. So, that being said, let's discuss some of the technical requirements and obligations when it comes to chinuch. So, first of all, we should understand that when a child is born, there is no obligation that we have as parents to train this child in mitzvahs whatsoever. So while it's very nice when you see a baby being brought to the bris with a yarmulke on his head, it's really silly. I mean, it's nice. It's nice pictures. People tell you, my father, my grandfather, great-grandfather, good. But sometimes people get all nervous and the yarmulke is falling off. It's silly. And I got news for you. When the child is 6 months old and the child is a year old and a year and a half and two, there's no toelus in it. There's no benefit. There's no need. And there's no obligation. So parents should not feel that pressure of trying to impose, it's a funny word to use, but try to in any way impose that which, as far as they're concerned, some expression of Avodas Hashem upon a child that is simply does not possess the understanding, the sophistication, the cognitive ability to have any idea what you're doing other than plopping something on his head. That being said, I will not deny that there's a mitzvah in the Torah, Hakil, in which the Torah instructs us to bring all of the members of Klal Yisrael to hear in the great reading of the Torah at the major assembly after the Shemitah year. And over there the Torah stresses that it's not only the adults, but even the children, the taf, the children that are not even old enough to speak, are going to come and they're going to participate in that experience. So I'm not suggesting that for the first 3 or 4 years old, a Jewish child is to be kept at home and completely, totally cut off from any religious life experience, which would obviously be impossible on a practical level, but I don't mean to suggest that. But at the same time, we need to understand that there's no obligation upon us as parents to go ahead and to train or to even expose our children at such young levels, such young ages, to any real, anything of any religious nature. There is, however, a mitzvah of chinuch, which is introduced upon the parents as the children get older. Now, time doesn't allow at this time, but there are a number of different sources, even in the Torah, that we can draw from, which would give us a base, which we could say, well, here, we see there's an obligation. So, for example, the mitzvah to teach children to our children, which is a mitzvah that applies all the time. Then we have a mitzvah of Higadus Levincha, specifically on the night of the Pesach Seder of Sipur Yitzias Mitzrayim. Then we have other concepts, Midirei Kabbalah, which come from the Nevi'im, the concept of Chanoch, Lenar, Apidarko, and there are certainly references that we can draw from, and perhaps to a certain extent there's an overlap, but I personally appreciate and like to convey that which I heard from Rabbi Shechter on a number of occasions, 2 points. Number one, the mitzvah of Chinuch is part of the mitzvah of Puruvu. You know, there are people who, I don't know if people even stop to think about, you know, the mitzvah of Puruvu, the obligation to have children, you know, when the obligation begins, when and if it ends. But most people think about it in terms of a very, very technical question of how many children is a person going to have. And that's it. And once the child is conceived and born and hopefully healthy, so then that's it. You know, I can check it off my to-do list. However, it should be that easy, but for those who are adults, okay, good. So Rashi has pointed out on many occasions that's not true, that the mitzvah of Puruvu is one that continues way beyond the child's birth. To the contrary, he even goes as far as to say that one can botch it if a person does not raise their child properly. So they may have, you know, brought children into the world in a physical sense, but if they do not follow through and bring their children to a spiritual independence, then perhaps they've not fully been mekayim in the mitzvah. And the flip side of that is, if it's not obvious, I'll say it, that the parents who adopt children are also able to be mekayim in the mitzvah puruvu on a different level, and perhaps even on a more profound level. They're just going to just bring children into the world and just stop right there. Obviously, I don't mean to imply that a person, God forbid, will abandon their child, but abandon them spiritually is not really a major accomplishment as opposed to adopting a child and raising that child and bringing them to Torah Chuppah Matan Tovim. So we should appreciate that as parents, we are constantly engaged in the mitzvah of Puruvu. It's not only a technical question of how many children am I going to have. The Chafetz Chaim as well explained that we should view the mitzvah of Chinuch as an extension of other mitzvahs that we're more familiar with, such as the mitzvah of Avas Hashem. The Rambam explains that a person, in order for a person to really be mekayim the mitzvah of loving God, so they are naturally going to want to share that love that they have with other people. So we typically think of applying this in the sphere of kiruv, and if there are people, I have neighbors, colleagues at work, I'm going to try to inspire them. That's all nice and that's all true. However, even within the home, if not especially within the home, that's an opportunity to demonstrate the love that I have for God by trying to instill that love within my children. So we don't want to get caught up on technical questions of, you know, what is the mitzvah chinuch and what's the source and show me in the Torah. There are so many aspects of our religious life which are very much entangled with the concept of chinuch. And finally, in regards to this, obviously the mitzvah of chinuch on a certain level and tochacha as well, which is a general mitzvah of rebuke, which applies under certain circumstances to people other than my children, extends even beyond the Gil HaMitzvah. So even if a child reaches the age of 13 for a boy, 12 for a girl, and they're technically, and I also, again, I'm amused by this all the time when I ask the kids, so what does it mean to become a Bar Mitzvah? Bar Mitzvah? So they all have the same answer, right? Now I'm on my own, right? Until now, everything that I did is on my parents' account. And I asked them, do you mean that if you just went ahead and, you know, you went yesterday to the mall and you just went on this big shopping spree and you stole everything in the mall? Not your fault at all? No. Well, it's maybe my fault, but my parents are blamed for the whole thing. But now it all falls on my shoulders. And from here on in, it's all on me. It's not really how it works, and it's a very, very oversimplified way of explaining and understanding a concept that certainly does have a firm basis and is true, but not certainly not to that extent. But we as parents must realize that, yeah, a child may have had the bar mitzvah, but the mitzvah of chinuch is something which goes way beyond, and to the contrary. I'm speaking now not so much from personal experience, really just starting But those in the room who have children that are past that age already can certainly attest to the fact that, you know, you haven't seen anything yet. You know, little kids, little problems, right? Marilyn, would you agree?
No.
Oh, come on. I set you up for that. Okay. Yeah. Okay, good. To every rule there's an exception. Good. Okay, so Baruch Hashem. In terms of the actual age of chinuch, so when does it begin? So the child's 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, so I just told you you don't have anything to worry about in terms of formal obligation. When does it begin? So there's an interesting difference that the poskim introduced between mitzvah sase and mitzvah shlosh sase, between positive mitzvahs and negative mitzvahs. And the idea being, and this is something we can relate to even as adults, that a positive mitzvah is something that requires, ideally, some understanding, a deeper level and appreciation of serving God. So number one, I have to appreciate, what does it mean? There's a concept of Hashem. Children do not have to understand God on a deep level. Most of us don't. But to understand what it means that there is a Hashem and we serve Hashem and that's something we want to do. So typically, and again, it does depend on the intelligence of the child and the personality of that child and the general, you know, degree of development of that child. But when a child begins to be able to properly understand the concept of Hashem, which is, as it's brought down, I'll say in the Sfarim, because you'll find many, many different places that talk about this, but typically they say around the age of 5 or 6. So now we have an obligation as parents to begin to not merely introduce, but to train our children in the performance of mitzvot. Now that doesn't mean that once a child understands that there's a Hashem and what that means to serve Hashem, then that's it. They're off and going. They have to now be able to do everything properly. We still have, hopefully, you know, 7 years at least, in order to be able to get them to that point where they're ready to go. I sometimes, when I talk to the kids beforehand, I say that really your life until now has been like batting practice. It's been like spring training. Right, so it's an important part. You know, if the players don't show up for batting practice, if they don't show up for spring training, it's going to be a lousy season. You have to get yourself in shape. So it's an important part of the process, but we shouldn't pressure ourselves to think, oh no, the obligation begins at 5 or 6. That means by the time my child's 5 or 6, they have to know how to do the dalet meaning properly, and if they mess up the order, then all of a sudden, you know, somehow failing as a parent. No, once we have the entire period of time. But at the same time, that obligation varies once again depending on the child and also the type of mitzvah that I'm training him in. So using that as an example, it's a perfect example. Not every child that's 5 or 6 years old is going to be able to shake the lulav properly. And we have to realize as parents that the mitzvah of chinuch, and this is a very, very important and often misunderstood concept, or people just don't know it. I don't know if they're misunderstanding that, I know, that we're supposed to train our children to perform mitzvahs properly, not to perform mitzvahs the way a 5 or 6 year old can. So based on that, it would be wrong to buy a child, let's say, a lulav that's puzzle. That means that we have to spend more money. So maybe, wait a second, some minutes. Nobody said you have to buy your child a lulav and esrog at all. I wasn't going to buy one for my son this year. He actually asked for one. So I say, he asked for the DS game, and he asked for this, and he gets all that. So I'm just saying, no, you can't have a lulav and esrog. So I had to buy him one. I had to. It was my pleasure, but I wouldn't have gone out of my way to buy him one had he not asked for it. But if he asked for it already, it's not right to go ahead and give him, you know, pardon the expression, but a lemon. I'm not going to give him a lemon because he knows, and even if he doesn't know, it's not right because he'll figure it out, and that's not the goal. The goal is not, again, for a four-year-old to walk around with the styrofoam, there's nothing wrong with that. But once I'm already engaged in the midst of chinuch, so I should not be substituting the real thing for imitation version. Parents will sometimes ask me if they could take the mezuzah and put it, you know, all the way down so when a kid walks into the room, they can kiss it. They don't have to, they can reach it. So, first of all, there's no obligation to kiss the mezuzah when you're going out of the room. But even if there were, that would not be proper, because the halacha requires that the mezuzah be on the upper third of the doorway. And to go ahead and to train, again, if we can call it training in a mitzvah, technically it's not, but if we can expose a child to a mitzvah for your room, then the mezuzah is going to be all down here. That's not the way we fulfill the mitzvah, so it's an improper way of teaching the mitzvah, so that is not the mitzvah chinuch. The mitzvah chinuch is to teach them when they can handle that load. And again, obviously this is going to vary from child to child. A child who is coordinated and is picks up on things quickly, so will be able to, you know, handle the sometimes very technical and detailed aspects of mitzvos in a more sophisticated, proper manner than others. And once again, there's nothing wrong if it takes months and years for them to master it. That's the point. But when they're not ready for it, it's not proper for us to expose them to it. Or it's not impose it upon them, and we certainly don't have an obligation to. Needless to say, when it comes to a mitzvah, which is what we say, talui b'leiv, so mitzvahs such as davening, or let's say kiddush, or avdalah, bracha, so here, traditionally, we teach our children to say brachos at very young ages. There's nothing wrong with that. To the contrary, that already is a very ancient practice and one that should be encouraged. But I'm not going to say that a child who's 5 years old has an obligation to hear kiddush, even mitam chinuch. Because even if they understand, yeah, we serve Hashem, they can't really relate to something as abstract as standing there and listening to a kiddush, which talks about the fact that God created the world in 6 days and he rested on the seventh. Because certain kids will be able to handle that, but many, it's just, they're just not ready for that. It may take some time when they're aged 7 or 8, maybe even some of them older, until they can really appreciate it. It's at that point where we have, once again, that obligation to see to it that they are fulfilling those mitzvos. So using that example, if the child comes late, you know, let's say the child wasn't at the table, and a 10-year-old walks in to the table Friday night. You didn't hear kiddush yet. So if the 10-year-old is old enough to say kiddush, so he or she should say it for himself at that point. If not, so then I as a parent have not only the right, but the obligation to go ahead and to repeat kiddush with God's name, holding a cup, on behalf of that child. That's what we mean when we say the obligation of chinuch. We mean that really the child should be fulfilling these mitzvahs. Yeah.
If you can, shouldn't you be, make him come to the table to hear kiddush?
Right, so that's...
So my son.
Right. So that.
I don't want to see him. I want to see
him. Right. So that's what we're not going to. I'm not going to allow myself to get drawn into that this evening because we're going to devote time to that later. The question of forcing kids because it's a much you know it's a very delicate question. So the answer is maybe yes, maybe no. And as we do not necessarily force anyone, any child that comes to the table, even if a child is 14, 15 years old, perhaps even more so. So I wouldn't say force, encourage in the most positive way. But we'll talk more about this later. I hope people are coming back, and if not, you know. Don't worry. I'll tell you. So you'll be able to hear it. So, if you can't come till later, so you're no pressure, but we'll talk about the concept of forcing children at a time in the future. I'm just talking about, the general concept of an obligation. Now, when it comes to mitzvahs lo taseh, you know, the prohibition of engaging in certain activities, so here begins at an earlier age. And now, we're not as interested in the child being able to connect to God on that more meaningful, abstract level of serving God. But once a child can basically understand, no, we don't do that. It's Shabbos, right? That's mukhsah. So once a child can understand that, can appreciate what that means, which is typically, again, it will vary, but maybe even as young as 4 or 5 years old, so that's at that point that these restrictions will begin to be introduced to our children. To be specific, a 2-year-old, a 3-year-old that is playing with a mukhsah toy does not have to be stopped. It's not even, I wouldn't even call it a midas chashidus for a parent to go ahead and say to the child, no, we don't touch that. It's just not, you don't have to do that to the child. It's not, you know, the child's enjoying playing with a toy that makes noise. They don't understand. Yeah, you could say it's mukhsah. You know, my kids, I imagine all kids are like this. They, if we say mukhsah too much, they think anything in life you can't do is mukhsah. Right, so then we have to fix that problem later and explain to them. Mukhsah is a very specific term, which means that certain things on Shabbos can't be moved. Right, but you know they grow up thinking you can't kill people because it's mukhsah. Right, no, you can't kill people. There's nothing to do with mukhsah. Mukhsah is a Shabbos thing. So again, we don't want to overexpose our children to the concept of mukhsah, mukhsah, mukhsah if they're not ready to really appreciate what it is that means. Now there is a prohibition and even a biblical prohibition for us as adults to cause or to instruct our children to engage in activities that are prohibited min HaTorah. So the best example of this, and we cannot apply this across the board for many reasons. I'm sorry? So I was even better than that. A case which does not come up in orphans, but I was even a more concrete example, is giving them non-kosher food. We would not go ahead, assuming the child is healthy and there are no health issues, obviously it's a completely different story. But if it's just a question of, you know, the child's in the store and they say, mommy, I want this candy. So, wait a second, Rafa actually just said, 3 years old, it's not an issue. No. So while it's true that if a child on their own is going and playing with a toy on Shabbos, you don't have to stop them. And maybe even if you actually saw them, let's say with a friend's house with a babysitter and they took something, you wouldn't have to pull it out of their mouth. But to go ahead and say, mommy, I want that candy and give it to the child, So that we would be prohibited from doing, because again, the food is not kosher, and we are not permitted to be machil. We cannot feed our children non-kosher food. It was not only because of the fact that they're ingesting it, which of course is perhaps even on a metaphysical level something we could appreciate. We're all familiar with the famous teaching of Chazal that Moshe Rabbeinu would not nurse from any of the Egyptian women because they were not Jewish, because they ate non-kosher food. And this was a mouth that in the future would go ahead and would converse directly with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So even at such a young age, somehow Moshe had this inherent repulsion, or you know, he repelled this type of food. What's interesting is, you know, that the Ramah actually quotes in Shulchan Aruch that a child should not drink the milk of a woman who eats non-kosher food. Now, what's interesting about that is that technically it's not forbidden. Now, milk is milk, it's kosher, regardless of whether a woman eats kosher. But the idea is, he says, because we see that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't. So the obvious question everybody asks is, wait a second, what, Moshe Rabbeinu, the whole reason why, because in the future he would talk to God, right? What does that have to do with my child? So the obvious answer is, who knows? Who knows? What, we're going to write off our children so young? The Chafetz Chaim makes this point, Yaakov Kamenetsky, it's a beautiful idea. Yeah, that's the way we should raise our children. Maybe one day my child will talk to God. Why? I'm going to say right now, no, that's only from Moshe Rabbeinu. That's not the way that we should raise our children. That's not the way we should, certainly in terms of the way we look at them, we should look at them like the sky's the limit, if that. So there is perhaps, I would say, even more of a repulsion that we'll have for feeding our children non-kosher food, but the concept of enabling them, or certainly instructing them, or causing them to violate a prohibition is something that applies to other areas as well. When it comes to kashrus, we must differentiate between non-kosher food and wading in between milk and meat. This is a very, very different issue. We have the practice, the custom, which is really what it is, of waiting a certain amount of time between eating dairy and meat. So most people, many people wait 6 hours, many wait five and change, some wait three, some wait one, that's very rare. Okay, so we have different customs. But that is something which is not, in other words, if I forget, and I eat the milk after meat, so then that would not be like ingesting non-kosher food. So when it comes to children, healthy children below the age of 3 do not have to wait at all. I think I sort of brought down that the child's mouth should be wiped, at least externally. They don't have to brush their teeth, they may not have teeth. But others, it's a child that literally, you know, chicken soup, or even, you know, it's not, you know, she would clean it first. But you don't have to wait. Once the child reaches the age of 3, again, as we're saying, maybe between the ages 3 to 6, so they should wait about an hour if possible, but they should not be forced if they're very hungry and very picky, so you don't have to force that upon them. Once they reach the age of 6 and they can understand and they see that their parents and their older siblings are waiting, so then they should be encouraged to wait, you know, appropriate intervals of time as they get older. So for an adult, you know, who hopefully waits 6 hours between every meal, so it's not such a big deal. A child who, you know, can't, to him, you know, 2 hours and 6 hours is all the same. So to say to a 7-year-old, you have to wait 6 hours is not, it's not necessary and it's not appropriate. We should build our children up slowly. So when they're probably by the age of 9 to 10 already, they're waiting that full amount of time. And again, even there, it requires, you know, common sense, and if there are any sort of conflicts, you should take a closer look at that. Now, you'd mentioned turning on the light, so that's another very common example, and one perhaps that's certainly more common, that we would confront such a situation on Shabbos, where we either forgot to do something, or we did everything right, somebody else messed up, and now our house is not Shabbos ready, and perfect. You know, why do we have to go next door and embarrass ourselves in front of the neighbors, our Shabbos guy, and we've discussed this in the past, even that's not always acceptable, but we're not going to talk about that today. So it would just seem especially convenient to go ahead and, you know, take my 4-year-old child and say, you know how I always tell you that this is book show? Well, sometimes it's not. Or, you know, don't tell him it's Shabbos, or just give him a lot of Benadryl and don't tell him what happened. God forbid, obviously. We can't do this. Not only we can't do it for two reasons. Not only because it's wrong, al-shirach, over here we are treading once again on very dangerous ground, because there was a prohibition for us as parents to cause our children to violate Yisurim, and perhaps over here you have an additional prohibition of, the Torah says specifically that you are to keep Shabbos, and lo sasha kamalacha ata uvincho vitecha. And what does it mean, vincho vitecha? If my child is 13 years old, or the girl is 12 years old, so Of course, they have their own personal obligation. So a rabbi say, you see from here, that a parent is not permitted to have their work done, not only, as the pasuk goes on to say, through animals, through non-Jews, through a servant, my children, even a young child doesn't understand, I cannot use that child to go ahead and do anything that I cannot do. So under no circumstances may I instruct the child to do something that's a benefit to me. There are certain circumstances, if there's something that's a benefit to the child, and it's not a question of necessarily instructing the child to do it as much as allowing the child to do it, so we don't have to necessarily have to get in the way. Or perhaps if we're dealing, and here we get very technical, we're not going to really focus on too many examples, but I'll give you one good one. Perhaps when it comes to violating an issue, the Rabbanan, a rabbinic prohibition, as opposed to a biblical one, so there's some room for leniency in certain circumstances. So a very practical application would be if the light in the child's room is on. Child obviously cannot sleep with the light on Shabbos. So it would be permissible, if we assume, and we will for the purpose of our discussion, that to turn off the light on Shabbos is only a rabbinic prohibition. Again, don't try this at home. We're not permitted to do it. But as opposed to turning on a light, turning off the light would only be a rabbinic prohibition. So it would be acceptable to ask a child, to instruct a child, to, you know, turn off the light if it will prevent the child from staying awake. But I say that that should be done with extreme caution, because you will have, very possibly, unless the child really is tired and will not remember this in the morning, too young, you'll have to deal with the repercussions of that the next day, or perhaps the next week, or perhaps the rest of your life. You know, my parents are a hypocrite, you know, when it's good for them. So maybe it may make more sense in those circumstances to just, you know, allow the child to sleep somewhere else that night. I don't know, but you have to be aware that even though it may be technically permissible, they will not forget it. They will certainly not. And that's something that, you know, sending those sort of mixed messages, even though we have the whole, we understand why it's different, the child may not necessarily understand. When it comes to reciting brachos, as I mentioned before, that's something that we do with our children, even from young ages when they're really even too young to understand what they're saying and why they're saying it. But again, it's an appropriate thing to do. I'm not saying one is obligated, but usually parents are eager, in a positive way, to expose their children to the, you know, less imposing, everyday, almost natural expressions of our service of God. And this is just the perfect example. Sitting at the table, what broccoli do you make on it? It becomes fun. The kids learn the different food groups. They learn, you know, how many other kids necessarily know, you know, where an apple grows as opposed to a banana grows at the end of age of 3 or 4. It gives us an opportunity to go ahead and discuss, you know, even, you know, like I said, more worldly matters, such as the food groups with our children. If we're going to recite brachos with our children, we can, and I would say even should, recite the bracha with them. I'm sure everybody knows this, but just to state for the record, it is not prohibited to go ahead and say the name of God again and again and again if it's for the purpose of training my children. So sometimes you see when people bench with their children, Baruch Atah Adon, I have seen kids bench that way. And it's wrong. They go, Baruch Atah Adon. You know, so that's exactly why we don't want to give them the pasul lulav. We don't want to put the mezuzah down. Benching is not baruch ata ado. You know, there's a whole name over there, and we shouldn't be reluctant as parents to go ahead and to teach them how to say God's name. It's more important that they learn how to say God's name than they learn how to say baruch ata, because many adults pronounce God's name incorrectly. Right, Judy? So it's very important that they hear from us again and again how that word is to be pronounced. That being said, it shouldn't be abused. They should learn that we have reverence for that name, and we don't abuse it. We don't just say, oh my God. We shouldn't say that in front of our children. But when it's appropriate to be said, so we shouldn't avoid it, we shouldn't, you know, refrain from leading by example under those circumstances. There are other subcategories that I have, you know, I mentioned a few. I don't want to hold you too late. But before I go on, if anybody has any questions on anything that I've said so far, just already, I know a lot of information has been accumulating slowly. So far, so good? Good?
Mm-hmm. Along the line between love and submission, what about tissues? All the little boys say tissues are special. I mean, you know, they get washed all the time. Do I need to make an effort to make sure that the little boys are tissues?
Yeah, they should be. If they should really be kosher. Now, there are ways to wash tzitzis without posseling them. I mean, it just takes a little more effort. You know, so even if you don't want to do it by hand, which is one way, they have tzitzis beds. You know, like they're like, okay, you try. Doesn't work. It doesn't work.
You know, after 5 or 6 washes, it's not,
right.
You know.
Okay, well. You said, you know, certainly it would be... well, how often do we need to be washed? Look at it that way, huh? Okay.
I guess there are no easier fat answers to any of these.
Right. Well, this,
depending on the age, depending on the kid.
No, well, I think if the child has already reached, you know, again, there is a tradition, you know, that some people have to start putting tzitzis on a child when they reach the age of three. There is no mitzvah chinuch at that age. So if you're going to put tzitzis on a child at the age of three, I'm not sure that you need to be so concerned at that age, even the age of three or four or five, that the tzitzis be kosher at all times. However, I don't know if you're talking about your own children, but once... Okay, so once he's 9 years old, his tzitzis should be kosher tzitzis. So I have no way of knowing how often you're going to have to change it. You know, if you want, you can let me know. But when, you know, when they become invalidated for use, they should be replaced. Now, again, there may be more. Again, clearly you've tried just about everything you've heard of, as you've indicated. So enjoy the pleasures of having boys. So, okay. Hopefully, Tzilin, Mr. Shem, will have one care and he'll take good care of it. Yeah.
Do you address Tila with kids and like the parents in order to educate the child?
Right, so that's a very good question. So, ideally, a parent should not, you know, compromise their own performance of mitzvos in order to perform another mitzvah of being machanek their children. So, if there need be a hashtag, I wouldn't say turn the page during Sukkah and Zim. I wouldn't say something like that. But if it's a question of interrupting, certainly Shmon Esrei, and maybe even if it was clear from our times in the davening that we typically would not talk, so it may be better to, you know, daven beforehand or afterwards. And that doesn't preclude you from being able to daven along with the child for the purpose of chinuch. I remember like when we used to go to camp, so very often I would try to bench before I benched with the kids. But if that didn't happen, I would bench with the kids. But I would be saying every word, but I would not be benching at that time. I'd be walking around, snapping, telling them to stop talking here and there. So they may have all thought I was benching. When I was done, I sat down and I benched because you couldn't do both at the same time. So, you know, that may be necessary, you know, depending on the types of interruptions that you'll encounter. Again, if there's a more specific question you have about a particular point of davening, you know, I can address it. But in a general sense, you know...
There is a solution. A child isn't sitting flopping at feet or whatever. You want them to learn. They have to stand with their feet together. You're saying you should not interrupt your two to tell them together.
That's a good question. Well, I would say this. If your child is interrupting, that's not the question you asked, but I'm going to say it anyway. If your child is interrupting anyone else in shul, then you should stop whatever you're doing and either take the child out, or yes, you should talk to them. That, no, it is unjustifiable for anybody to, you know, allow their children to interrupt other people in shul, and even if it means stopping one's own shmoneh esrei, that's a dinner shul chanuch. You could take a child and walk with them while you're in the middle of shmoneh esrei if necessary. So, But if it's a question of, I don't think it would be appropriate to actually, you know, verbally communicate with the child during Kedusha if it's just a question of, you know, this is how we stand, because that's the kind of thing that you can point out afterwards, later. If you can show them through hand motions, fine, and then you'll have opportunities, again, later to explain to them, and hopefully they'll get it. I mean, well, again, I guess what I'm trying to say is I think you can, Esther Lakai's name, I think you can really do both. At this moment, I may have to make a decision between my Kedusha and my child's learning this particular, you know, detail within the laws of Tefillah. But so then, making a call on the spot, I would think that your Kedusha would technically win. But in the big picture, you can do both. In other words, again, the child still has, hopefully, weeks, months, years to go, and hopefully when the time comes, they'll know how to do it properly. So that would be, you know, again, as a rule, I think we should try not to have to compromise our own performance of this. So, yeah?
If you're davening at home and you're in the middle of davening yourself, you know, interrupt you, and they can't understand, they can't wait to speak to you now.
So I think children need to, they need to understand, again, if the child is 2 years old, then of course they can't understand, and maybe it's not appropriate to be davening when there's a 2 year old awake who may do that. But, you know, if that's not the case, if the child is already older, so then they need to understand. You know, they need to understand. I'm not available right now. You know, forgive me if a parent says I'm going to the bathroom. You know, I'll be out in 5 minutes. Children, they may not like it, but they understand. I can't disturb mommy right now. So, you know, right now the dominant choice. So you may have to give them a certain cue, like this. My kids, I never explained this to them, but they seem to have picked up on it. They understand that. You know, I just leak that I sometimes daven at home. I'm a struggle now, but. You know, they know when a person's davening in Shmoneh Esrei. My son almost regularly comes, you know, when he'll come to shul, he usually comes most of the time, so he'll come right over and say, I'll see. He won't get it, he'll ask once. And he's not, you know, it's not that he's such a patient child. He's actually, if I was on the phone, he would keep pulling. But he seems to have picked up on that. I don't remember actually instructing him as such, but he understands. If he calls once, my eyes are closed, they're looking in the sitter, and everybody else in shul is quiet. I've got to wait. And he seems to have just accepted that. And again, so I think we just need to explain to them that that's protocol. And they'll understand, hopefully. Okay, I'll just make a couple more points. And then maybe when we get together next time, I'll pick up where we left off. Just discuss a number more sort of miscellaneous dinim. In terms of, you know, seeing to it that our children do not engage in prohibited behavior, so I think we need to be ever mindful that this is not limited merely to what they put in their mouth or moving mooks on Shabbos. Perhaps even more importantly, I would say definitely more importantly, parents need to train their children and obviously lead by modeling an example as to what is appropriate behavior in some of the more, they're not really gray areas, but just in terms of the way we practice and the realities of our life. So we do not necessarily look upon the prohibition of speaking lashon hara in the same way that we would look at, you know, turning on a light on Shabbos. It's just the way it is. Technically, you know, it's the very same Torah that prohibits both activities. You know, speaking falsehoods, using profanities in the home, lying to our children in front of our children. The Gemara actually specifically singles that out as being a very dangerous and really repugnant behavior. The Gemara says the parent has to be very careful to follow through on promises. And if you made a mistake and it's something you should not have said to your child, you have to bite the bullet because it'll come back to hurt you. And I'm sure you know as well, but I can't help but speak from personal experience. This is certainly true. Our children will call us on these things and will want to know, you know, why is it that you're allowed to, and they'll say it as disrespectful as it is, why are you allowed to lie when it's good for you, but I can't lie. So we have to really lead by example and understand that these are prohibitions. This is not just me though. So it goes without saying that we have to lead by example when it comes to. But these, our children need to know that this is, you know, this is considered a prohibition, and therefore I need to once again lead by example. There are certain gray areas which I struggle with, and I don't have any good answers to. These again probably borders a little more on the hashkafa. But when it comes, let's say, to allowing our children to watch movies, what types of movies are they allowed to watch? It's very, very tricky because there are the PG movies that are out today. There's a lot of words in the PG movies that we wouldn't say. So it's not quite the same thing as our saying these words in front of our children. But then again, how different is it really? And I know that we have told our children, and they believe us, and it's true to a certain extent, that if the movie's good for you, it's good for us. If it's not good for you, it's not good for us. In our house, thankfully we don't go to movies all the time, so it's not an issue. But if we did, it would be a problem. But, you know, I'm not going to tell my 13-year-old child, you know, you cannot watch this movie, but me and mommy can. Unless I could somehow prove to them that really it's a quote-unquote kosher movie, but, you know, there's certain material in here. It's a movie about the Holocaust, and I don't think you're ready for that. Another year or two, you'll be ready. So that's something else. But if it's a movie, that's not appropriate for a child. So that's the type of message that we need to convey to our children at all times, and especially once again in terms of the way we speak and conduct ourselves in their presence. Hopefully at all times we should be echo the pen, echo the lay, we should be sincere individuals, but we need to really constantly put on an act in front of our children so they can, you know, learn properly the right way to act. And finally, I'll conclude with one other area of halacha, which is very, very difficult for us to model as parents. It will become self-evident when I say what it is. But one that we need to also, we have an obligation as parents to teach them how to treat their parents. So obviously, for those who we aimhara have parents that they can care for and take care of and show and demonstrate kavod, so that's a perfect opportunity to show our children what it means. But even those who are blessed to have parents, unless they actually live in the home, children will not be able to, you know, see that on a regular basis, and so therefore we really need to be machanich them as to the proper way to talk to parents and to communicate to parents. And it sometimes comes across, if it's in a certain way, certainly as kids get older, as being, you know, somewhat self-serving, and, you know, of course you're going to tell me I need to treat you that way. But again, we can set by example when we talk to them about their teachers. And about, again, I don't take it personal, that's what people say about me when I'm not around, but about the rabbis. You know, if we're going to say to our children, you know, you need to speak to us a certain way, even if you don't agree with us. You know, it's not proper to speak to your parents that way, but if they see that at the table, you know, we don't have that same regard for people who are in a position of authority in our life, and their teachers, and we don't respect their teachers in their presence. Your teacher did what? I'm going to call the principal. So even if you're right, and again, teachers are certainly, you know, oftentimes make mistakes. That's not the point. But if we're going to speak this way in front of our children and to our children, then we're going to greatly compromise our ability to be able to train them as to the proper way to demonstrate respect and reverence for people of authority in their life, including ourselves. So we really have an obligation there as well to train them how to be mechabe their parents. And it's not an easy one to lead by example, but it's one, once again, that we have a specially unique opportunity and responsibility there as well. So I'm going to end now. It's been almost an hour. I thank you for your, first of all, your attendance and your interest in this topic. When we get together next week, I can't make it because I have parent-teacher conferences as the teacher, 5:30 to 10:30. Misery, but what could you do? So in 2 weeks from tonight, on that following Tuesday, I think we're going to pick off where we left off and talk about some of the more, as I said before, some of the more philosophical or a little more, I would say, less concrete applications of chinuch in general, and be able to address that particular question you asked and other related questions at the time as well. Okay, thank you. Have a wonderful night.